This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Nobody ever asks, well, what size economy do we really want? And what size economy can nature actually provide for over the long term? Nobody asks those obvious questions. And so what happens as a result is we just continue growing until we hit the wall. And I argue in the book that we're in the process of hitting the wall right now.
One of the best things about having your own radio show is being able to sit down with really interesting thinkers and hear them discuss the critical problems of our era, as well as their best ideas for solving those problems. Today on Sea Change Radio, I talk with Richard Heinberg, author and senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, who's written extensively on energy, economic, and ecological issues. The last time he was a guest on this program, he described some of the fundamental problems surrounding our carbon-based economy. This week, we welcome Mr. Heinberg back to the show as we discuss his latest article published in Energy Bulletin titled, What We Are For. In the next half hour, listen as Richard Heinberg gives us his thoughts on how to promote eco-literacy, why empowering women is good for the planet, and what environmentalists can learn from the Occupy movement. My guest on Sea Change Radio is Richard Heinberg. He's the author of End of Growth, as well as he has a new piece on energybulletin.net called What We're For. He is a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and has been on this show before as well. Richard, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be with you, Alex.
We've discussed your book, The End of Growth, on Sea Change Radio before, and I highly recommend listeners go into the archives at seachangeradio.com and check it out. But can you just give us a quick summary of your thesis behind The End of Growth?
Right. The book is really an argument that and economic growth, as we've known it over the past few decades, is coming to an end. And it's really only in the last few decades that we've had the kind of economic growth we're talking about, GDP growth, continual growth in consumption. And I argue it's coming about due to the convergence of three factors: debt, depletion, and especially depletion of energy resources like oil that make economic activity possible. And finally, the third D is disaster, the increasing impacts of climate change and industrial accidents like the Deepwater Horizon and Fukushima nuclear disaster that are making it impossible for insurance companies to value risk and that are increasing their direct costs to society. So, you know, this is kind of a big deal. We depend upon economic growth, and we've redesigned our economy, our financial system to depend upon continual economic growth. So if that's no longer available to us, that means we're really going to have to rethink a lot of the basics of how we do business.
Maybe it's not just the way our politics have approached it and our day-to-day attitudes of more and more consumption.
Right.
But some of the economics, the principles, let's throw out the supply siders for a second, but in liberal Keynesians, they always are contending that the path to growth is for full employment or X, Y, or Z. It's not so simple, though, in your estimation, now that a post-carbon world gets put into the equation.
Right. As long as the economy is growing, we're consuming more. And that means we're drawing down Earth's resources, and that includes water, topsoil, minerals, as well as fossil fuels. We're undermining habitats, and we are driving species into extinction as we grow the economy. Well, there's an obvious problem there. You can't grow something forever on a finite planet. I don't, when we talked before, I can't recall if I used this metaphor, but you know, a baby hamster doubles its weight every week. What would happen if that baby hamster kept doubling its weight every week for an entire year? How big a hamster would we end up with? Well, it would be a 9 billion ton hamster. You know, of course, that's absurd. In nature, things don't grow forever, but somehow we've gotten the idea that our economy can and should grow forever, and we've built that into all our economic theories, whether, as you say, whether they're Keynesian or Austrian economic theory or Milton Friedman's monetarism. I mean, you go through the list of standard economic ideologies, and most of them, with the exception of ecological economics and biophysical economics, most of them have growth as their central assumption, that that's the end-all and be-all of good economic management and economic health.
And that, of course, has filtered right into our political rhetoric. You always hear politicians saying, you know, to grow the economy, we need to get green jobs or whatever. But the goal is always to grow.
Absolutely. Nobody ever asks, well, what size economy do we really want? And what size economy can nature actually provide for over the long term? Nobody asks those obvious questions. And so what happens as a result is we just continue growing until we hit the wall. And I argue in the book that we're in the process of hitting the wall right now.
I could understand wanting to always grow it to at least keep up with our growing global population. But and to feed as many people as we possibly can on this planet. But if you look at our planet as a house, you wouldn't always just be looking for extensions to grow the house. You'd be trying to make a better house, a more efficient house.
Right. And well, there's the question of population, too. I mean, if you only have a certain size house, then if you're always adding people to that house, that more or less forces you to add on rooms, or either that or else. People have less and less space and they start to get more miserable. And both things are happening now. We are adding on rooms, we're growing our economies and our consumption on a per capita basis, but also a lot of people are not sharing in that wealth and misery in many parts of the world is actually growing. So reducing population growth and in fact deciding what level of population we can and want to sustain over the long term, these are really important discussions.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is the author Richard Heinberg. His latest book is The End of Growth. He's also a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. And Richard, we're going to link to your piece on energybulletin.net. It's entitled What We Are For. Let me read just a couple sentences for our listeners here. You say, sometimes it's useful to reframe the discourse about ecological limits and economic restructuring in positive terms. That is, about what we're for. And then the subheadings are energy literacy, conservation, resilience, relocalization, family planning, beauty, and biodiversity. We were just talking about population. Why don't we skip ahead to what you write about family planning in this piece, What We Are For.
Right. Well, family planning and population, sound population policy are not just about avoiding some awful future of overpopulation and famine and so on. Although that's a really good, valid and good reason for population policy, but it's also about making life better for people in the here and now. You know, in countries that have very large and fast-growing populations, it's really hard to keep poverty at bay. If you have a typical family size of, you know, 5 or 6 or 8 children, if it's a poor family, typically all of their money has to go to pay for food and shelter, and there's nothing left over for education or for forming a family business or anything like that. So families get mired in poverty generation after generation after generation. And it's in countries that have reduced population growth that we see the development of better economies. Now, we were just talking about economic growth. It's true, economic growth is not the be-all and end-all, but the solution to economic growth is not universal poverty. You know, it is possible for people to improve their conditions if they reduce their demands on the natural world. And there are two ways of doing that, either by reducing per capita consumption or by reducing the number of capitas, reducing population. And I think we're going to have to do both. But if we reduce population, if we have family planning, if we improve the lives of women in poor countries so that they can plan themselves how many children they'd like to have.
Or just get basic things like access to contraception. There's over 200 million women in the world that are estimated not having access to birth control and contraception. That's insane.
That's right. But if we do those things, the result is better lives for everyone. So that's something to be for.
Don't want no lovin', don't want no kissin', don't want no gal to call me honey. Don't want my name in the Hall of Fame, just want a big fat pile of money. Give me that almighty dollar for that lettuce, hear me holler. Give me buckets full of ducats, let me walk around and waller in Mazuma, El Dinero, want to be a millionaire. Give me money, 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 money. I want that green ammunition, that's the stuff for which I'm wishing. Fill my closets with deposits, I'm a demon at addition. Give me shekels, give me pesos, let me see their smiling faces. Money, 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 money. I want to get me a suit that's made out of loot and whistle the wearing of the green.
At Sea Change Radio, we're trying to get a better idea of who's listening to the show, so we're conducting a confidential survey. Just follow the link at seachangeradio.com and answer a few basic questions. It'll only take a few minutes, and we promise it won't hurt a bit. By participating in our survey, you can also be entered into a drawing with a chance to win some absolutely fabulous prizes. Please go to seachangeradio.com and click on the link labeled Survey. It's a great way to support the show, and it won't cost you a dime.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is the author Richard Heinberg. Something, a term I had never heard of before, but I think it's so critical that it becomes a more ubiquitous term, energy literacy.
Right.
Explain what you think energy literacy means, and how do we teach the next generation to be able to be energy literate?
Well, you know, energy is maybe the most decisive factor in ecosystems and human economies. If you understand energy, then you're much better able to understand how nature works and how the economy works. But not many people do understand energy, even though some of the simple principles are very simple, like the laws of thermodynamics, the first and second law. You know, you can't create energy or destroy energy, but energy tends to follow its bliss. You know, it tends to move from areas of high concentration to low concentration. Basic concepts like energy return on energy invested. It takes energy to get energy. So how much energy do you get back at the end of the day? If folks understand these basic principles, they're better able to evaluate a lot of the claims made by the fossil fuel industry and also by the renewable energy industry and make better decisions, political decisions and also household decisions about what kind of energy to use, how much energy to use, what the real costs of energy consumption are. So energy literacy is something that I think everybody could benefit from. And actually, it's I have found in my own experience, learning about how energy works is one of the most liberating and empowering things I've done in my life.
I was thinking of influential book from it may be over a decade now, but Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas, talking about how people will continually vote against their best interests. Connect the dots for us in terms of people not being energy literate and not voting in their own best interest.
Well, a good example is ethanol. You know, ethanol has become very popular in the Midwest, where farmers get enormous subsidies for growing huge amounts of corn to turn into ethanol to put in our gas tanks to run our cars. And something like 40% of all the corn being grown in the U.S. now is going to make ethanol. Well, you know, the idea, of course, is that it makes us less dependent on foreign oil. And it does to a certain extent, but it's the amount of imported oil that all of that corn is displacing is actually pretty small. And the costs to the environment of topsoil loss and depletion of fresh water are considerable. And then if you bring in the subject of energy returned on energy invested, well, it turns out that it costs almost as much energy to make a gallon of ethanol as you get from burning the gallon of ethanol in the engine of your car. So it from an energy standpoint, it just doesn't make sense. From an ecological standpoint, it doesn't make sense. The only way it makes sense is from a political standpoint of providing a subsidy to some farmers. So, you know, energy literacy in that instance is, I think, really, really important.
How can we teach energy literacy to the part of America which may actually be more in touch with the land on many levels in terms of hunting and fishing and living off the land than the people on both coasts and people who may be more environmentally conscious? But those people who are living off the land, if you go into these more rural areas, you're going to see big trucks, you're going to see jet skis towed on the back. There's much more of a love for burning fossil fuels. Is there, yeah. how do we, that's kind of what I was talking about with Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas? Like, how do we make those people see the long term rather than just enjoy nature and burn as much fossil fuel while we're here?
It's not exactly a solution to that, but one thought I've had for some time is, you know, as energy gets more expensive, particularly oil, we really need ways to help people make better decisions in their own lives about the energy that they're using. And one idea I've had is to promote a new career, new career choice among young people, which is to be energy coaches. And of course, to finance this, you might need some way of raising money within local communities, maybe at the federal level, I don't know. But these people obviously need to be paid for their time. But
like a nutritionist or something, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, people who understand energy and are able to go and talk to folks in their homes and measure how much energy they're using now and give them advice on how they can save money by using less energy in ways that actually don't cost them much, if anything, in terms of quality of life.
The problem is most of the energy coaches right now are energy efficiency companies that may have deals in place with insulated windows, but you're proposing making this a wider swath of a whole new subset of specialization. Is that right?
Right, right. I mean, for some people, the best thing they could do to save energy might be to ride a bicycle. For other people, it might be to insulate their home. For other people, it might be to change their windows and you know, buy more windows with a higher insulated value. It just depends. And so, you know, if the energy efficiency expert is coming from a company that is selling a particular product, you know, they're going to want to sell that product. But what you really want is a broad view of the whole picture that takes into account transportation, food, insulation, electricity consumption, you know, all the powered devices that might be left on overnight and so on. Somebody who can look at a utility bill and help people in the household decode it and understand what they're really paying for.
And it doesn't have to be a right or a left leaning household. These people are actually here to help you, and you can prioritize it. Going back to your article about biodiversity, human beings and Americans are very diverse, and our situations and our priorities are diverse. So just trying to say, well, everyone should be riding a bike and everyone should be eating more fruits and vegetables, those aren't real solutions. But having energy coaches who can actually get to know the families and to help them make their own decisions doesn't have to be coming from an ideological perspective.
That's right. And it can all be framed in terms of reducing energy bills, reducing oil, gasoline, you know, outlays and so forth. So it's, you know, it's in the interest of the people who are being served. It's not, again, as you say, it's not ideological.
Well, it's a terrific idea. I hope it gets adopted in the as a piece of the green jobs movement.
Yeah.
So you've been following a lot of the grassroots movements and what is now known as the Occupy movement, whether it's Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Oakland. Tell our listeners your thoughts and how you think it might be tying together some of the things that you've been fighting for in the past.
Right. Well, you know, I view the Occupy movement as our domestic U.S. version of a broader global phenomenon that I call the end of growth uprising. You know, people in countries around the world that maybe have put up with dysfunctional or corrupt or authoritarian regimes for years, even decades, are now finding that because of their declining economies, suddenly it's not so easy to put up with that kind of stuff anymore. Take the countries of North Africa and the Middle East, you know, countries with rapidly rising populations, lots of young people who are unemployed. In those countries, as around the world, costs of food and fuel are rising very rapidly. And so people who have to spend a lot of their income, a very large portion of their income on food and fuel, suddenly find, you know, they just can't make ends meet, particularly if there's no job. So suddenly these people have nothing left to lose, and they're pouring out into the streets and changing regimes. Well, what's happening here in the U.S.? Similar kind of thing. You have lots of young people who have very few job prospects and in a lot of cases have enormous amounts of student loan debt, and they can never get out from under that because of the special rules that apply only to student loans. You have people who are deeply concerned about corruption here in the United States. I mean, corruption is usually defined as a few bad actors breaking the rules. But what we've done over the past 20 years or so is we've really changed the rules. Well, I shouldn't say we. What's actually happened is the financial industry has changed the rules. And now, you know, when somebody is appointed to the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Federal Reserve Board or the U.S. Treasury at high executive positions, they're almost always people from the banking industry. So, you know, to use a tired metaphor, it's, you know, the fox guarding the chicken coop. We have no more real regulation of the banking industry except the smaller banks. The bigger banks, the ones that take on the most risk, can do basically anything they want. And if they gamble their money away, they get bailed out by the taxpayers. Well, people are outraged by this, but there's no solution from within the system itself. You can't just elect different people to Washington because both political parties are completely beholden to Wall Street. The only real hope is to go out into the street and protest. So that's what people are doing. So I think the Occupy movement is, from a historical perspective, once you understand that we are at the end of economic growth as we've known it, from a historic perspective, I think it's absolutely inevitable that this kind of thing will happen in most countries around the world, if not all.
Which way are you going? Which side will you be on? Will you stand and watch while all the seeds of hate are sown? Will you stand with those who say, let his will be done? One hand on the Bible, one hand on the gun. One hand on the Bible, one hand on the gun.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is the author Richard Heinberg. Tell us what you think the Occupy movement has done for the environmental movement, and maybe that's manifested itself in some of the recent success we've seen with the Keystone Pipeline.
Yeah, well, you know, it's pretty clear what we need in this country in order to avert environmental catastrophe, and that is to get off of fossil fuels as rapidly as possible. Fossil fuels are, of course, implicated in climate change, but also as time goes on, as we deplete the formerly abundant fossil fuels, conventional oil, conventional natural gas, and the high grade anthracite core that we used to mine in Pennsylvania, stuff like that. And increasingly, we're going to low grade, hard to get oil, coal, and gas, like the deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico, the tar sands in Alberta, the fracking gas. And as we do this, as we go to lower and lower grade hydrocarbons, the environmental risks are skyrocketing. The environmental risks from industrial accidents like the Deepwater Horizon disaster that fouled the entire Gulf of Mexico, the tar sands that are the dirtiest oil on the planet, and that's what we're planning on, as expanding tar sands production. Fracking gas, shale gas that pollutes water, that is actually has a worse greenhouse gas profile than coal. So, okay, we know what we have to do. We have to get off of fossil fuels and develop renewable energy. Why aren't we doing it? Well, it's because of political corruption. It's because we have the best Congress money can buy, because we have a political system where campaigns are funded by the highest bidders. And the highest bidders in many cases are either the financial industry or the fossil fuels industry. And guess what? We don't get any fundamental change in either area. So I think the Occupy movement is really about putting an end to this fundamentally corrupt political and economic system that has been developed for us over the past few decades. And frankly, I don't see any other strategy lying around that's likely to succeed in putting an end to that.
Yeah, you write that the Occupy movement, quote, "We need a post-growth economy that works both for people of all of them and for the rest of nature, a localized economy based on renewable resources harvested at nature's rate of replenishment, not a fossil-fueled global economy driven by the imperative of ever higher returns on investment." I think that's pretty well said.
Right. I think the next step for the Occupy movement could be to find indoor structures that they can occupy more or less permanently, not just in protest, but also serving basic community needs. You know, every community has alternative structures of all kinds, whether it's for transportation, car share, ride share programs, local food programs, farmers markets, and so on. Well, if the Occupy folks could bring all of those things together in a very visible place in downtown of towns across the country, they could solve practical problems for people in hard economic times, and at the same time get their point across about government and financial corruption in ever more effective ways. And I think the fact that the Occupy movement is largely being led by young people who have generally, in my experience, a pretty high level of environmental awareness is a very good thing. And it's going to help the movement, I think, not only succeed politically, but also, you know, help us solve a lot of problems that are plaguing this country.
Richard Heinberg, the author of The End of Growth, and his latest article is What We Are For in Energy Bulletin. Richard, thanks so much for coming back to Sea Change Radio.
It's always a pleasure talking with you, Alex. Thanks.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Angelique Kijo, Mel Blanc, and Jim Croce. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.